You're listening to Rock the Boat, a purpose-driven podcast highlighting Asians who challenge the status quo. Our mission is to elevate the voices of Asians, showcase the diverse careers of Asians around the world, and discuss important topics affecting our community, such as mental health and civic engagement. I'm your host, Lucia Liu. Hey listeners, happy holidays. This is the last episode of season five. As you recall, season five is a season highlighting Asian Americans in politics and civic engagement. To end the season, I'm inviting Lynn back on the pod to catch up and talk about one of the biggest political issues that is near and dear to my heart, U.S.-China relations. Lynn's classmate, Hua Chu, will be joining us today in our discussion as well. Hua comes with a very unique story. Her husband, who is an academic, was held hostage in Iran for nearly 4 years. Hua's husband was eventually released, but only after Iran proposed a trade with the United States. While the U.S. and China haven't gotten to the point of leveraging hostage diplomacy to interact with one another, it is a cautionary tale of how two countries who view each other with hostility can cause a lot more harm than good to its citizens. All right, here's the conversation. Lynn, you are back on, and I am very excited to hear an update from you on where you've been and how you're doing since you've left the Pete Buttigieg campaign and the podcast.
Yeah, it's really exciting to be back on. It feels like forever, like a lifetime ago. And seriously, it feels like everything has changed. The world is turned upside down as we speak to each other in our respective locations.
Yeah. Well, so why don't you tell our audience where you are?
Yeah. So I'm currently in grad school studying public policy at Princeton School of Public and International Affairs. I feel fortunate to have been able to come to campus during this unprecedented time. They only allowed grad students and a certain portion of undergrad students to come back during the fall. Mm-hmm. I feel like it's even more challenging trying to absorb this material virtually. So that's definitely been an adjustment, just getting back into the zone of doing problem sets and writing papers. For the most part, I do appreciate the rigor of the program. And it's part of the reason why I was really drawn to Princeton's program specifically, because not many other public policy programs have such a big focus on quantitative skills. Mm. And it's something that I wanted to improve in. So here I am.
I think it's really cool that you're back in school and you're in a learning environment. I feel like you definitely thrive in that, because I think you're so cerebral.
That's a nice way of putting it, Lucia. It was actually really nice being here during the election time, because, you know, we all care a lot about politics and the state of our country. So it was a nice, we, as a group, we would get together and make phone calls, write postcards. A group of us also went to Philly on the day of the election to volunteer and canvass. So it was a nice time to be in community with sort of other civic-minded, public-oriented people. So I felt like we built some solidarity around that. I do enjoy my international relations class, which is actually how I know Hua, who we'll meet in a bit. But I'm planning to concentrate or focus in international relations. So that class was a great introduction to frameworks and theories for thinking about international relations. And there's so much happening in that sphere right now. And so we were able to have a lot of lively discussions around the state of the world, U.S.-China relations, and other relevant topics, which is nice.
Yeah, absolutely. So why international relations, Lynn?
I think I went back and forth about it quite a bit, because most of my background is focused in more domestic policy. But something I've come to realize, especially in the last few years, is that domestic issues and international issues really overlap. They are converging. And we see that in the state of our country right now. And even just like COVID is a perfect example that what right. happens in like one part of the world affects all of us. And yeah. we cannot be ignorant to that. Personally, for me, you know, I've always enjoyed traveling and I've always considered myself a globalist, a student of the world, but more in like a casual sense. And I think for both personal reasons and just from a societal perspective, I feel like being able to connect domestic and international issues is very important. And I'm personally really interested in U.S.-China relations. Obviously, I'm Asian American. I have family living in Asia. So I really care a lot about formal relations between the two countries. They are mm-hmm. at a very pivotal moment now. And mm-hmm. I really do think that the next 10, 20 years are really going to transform the state of the world, specifically yeah. in how West and East decide to interact with each other. And right, so I right. want to gain a better understanding of that.
Yeah, super cool. And that's super exciting. I mean, I think one of the reasons why we're connecting today is to talk a bit about what you've been learning at school and also discuss how U.S.-China relations kind of impact us in general mm-hmm. as like Asian Americans, but also for me specifically because I'm of Chinese descent. And today, Lynn, you're bringing on a classmate of yours, Hua, right? So love to meet Hua.
Absolutely. Yeah, I'm so happy that Hua could join us. And I'm actually going to have her introduce herself. But just to give some context, we're both in international relations course together that we both took this fall. It was a great class. Hua can speak more to it. But we talked a lot about U.S.-China relations. No one in the class had actually lived in China except for Hua. So Hua's perspective was always extremely valuable because one of the weaknesses, I'd say, international relations theory, particularly in the West, is that it always is going to come from a Western perspective. It's just inevitable because the people who are coming up with these theories are typically white men, and there's a bias that comes with it. And so Hua would always be quick to point out the things that we were missing, or at least to inject a much needed Eastern Chinese perspective on some of these very Western-centric models that we base our theories on.
Well, Hua, thank you so much for joining us on Rock the Vote today. I'm so excited to meet you. Lynn has mentioned that you have a lot of personal stories as well on international relations. But yeah, do you mind quickly introducing yourself, when you came to the States, and then how you became a student like Lynn?
Thank you so much, Lucia and Lynn. Thank you for the very kind introduction. I grew up in Beijing, China, and educated in China as well. And I moved here in 2014 when my husband became a PhD student in history at Princeton. Mm. So my husband is the Princeton student taken hostage by Iran when he went to Iran in 2016. And he got picked up in the summer and was imprisoned for 14 months. So actually this week is the first anniversary of his release. So this is a very special moment for us. And actually before his release, I'm thinking about going to policy school because I really want to put my life transforming experience to good use plus my legal background. So that's why I'm here. I feel extremely fortunate to be part of the program and have so many wonderful cohorts like Lynn who bring a diverse perspective.
Back in 2008, Hua obtained a law degree from Columbia Law School in New York and returned to Beijing to work as a corporate lawyer. After a few years working in Beijing, Hua decided to immigrate to the United States with her husband to support him while he was working on his PhD. That was in 2014. And less than 2 years later, her husband was detained in Iran as a hostage. Here's a brief clip from CBS News explaining the situation.
Now, a CBS News exclusive, Margaret Brennan spoke with the wife of a Princeton University scholar imprisoned in Iran since his arrest 3 years ago today. Zhiwei Wang is one of at least five Americans held in Iran, and efforts to free Wang have stalled.
For 3 years, Hua Chu has fought for her husband Xie Wang's release.
He lived in a very cramped underground cell with no electrolyte, living together with over 25 cellmates. He developed a series of medical conditions.
She has struggled to explain it to their son, Xiaofan.
He was barely three when my husband left home for his research. And he's now six. He missed him for half of his life already.
State Department officials tell CBS News that a recent prisoner swap offer by Iran is not serious, and they point out that Iran has used Americans to extract concessions from U.S. presidents for decades. Nora, the U.S. is now asking other countries to pressure Iran to release the five detained Americans.
He went to Iran in 2016, in January. And he planned to come back in the summer. And the day before his return, he got picked up by the intelligence. There are 3 weeks that he was put on interrogations, but he still had freedom. And then in August, he got detained. They told him that we're sending you to the airport and you can leave the country. But they sent him to the Evin prison, the notorious Evin prison. And he has been held since the summer of 2016 until last December, December 7th.
I think what's so interesting about your husband's story and about what you had to go through and like what prompted you to decide to study public policy and use your law background in order to prevent something like this from happening to other people, or to at least understand why this was happening.
Yeah, this is literally a geopolitical game between two powers. And Iran is still doing this hostage diplomacy, the so-called diplomacy to get these people released. It's very sad, but this is still happening. I feel really deeply grateful that he was not broken by this traumatic experience. And after he came back, I mean, even under COVID, he's strong enough to continue his studies and research and keep writing. And I think he can do that is because there are so many people in the government and outside the government who supported me, supported him, and give him a lot of encouragement. I think because he's academic and people value that he's student, he's academic, he's non-political, he's so innocent and vulnerable, and this is so injustice for him to have to live through all of this horrible, horrific treatment in the prison. People do feel for it. And because it is humanitarian case, people make such effort.
It's good to hear that there were a lot of people in the government who were supportive of his case, because it could have gone a very different direction.
Yeah, the first year was very difficult. His case was kept quiet. Well, so it's all about politics, nothing about himself. When the U.S. policy on Iran became clarified, so in the second year and the third year, it's become much easier to get people involved to work towards his release than the first year, because when the U.S. government has no clear position in this hostage issue at large, it's very difficult to do anything about it.
Well, thank you so much for sharing your story. Your story is just like, every time I hear it, it's so powerful. I mean, it's not every day that you meet someone who was held hostage, not you, but your husband. So I'm sure it's not an easy story to recount. But one thing I wanted to mention is that I think Hua's story really draws upon the power or the importance of soft power and the diplomacy that does go on behind the scenes, which, you know, doesn't necessarily get reported in the news. So I think that soft power that the U.S. employed, as well as all the other countries and individuals supporting Hua's husband and pushing for his release, like that all mattered. And I think like in an age where we are questioning a lot of the significance of a lot of institutions, it's important to remember that those values, particularly in humanitarian cases, really do stand out. And I'm glad to hear that eventually it resulted in a positive outcome with Hua's husband being able to be released. But to your point, Lucia, about things being politicized, you know, that is very much the case. And there is a distinction between Hua's husband, who was a history student, versus students now of Chinese or Asian descent who are studying STEM fields. And we all know that the U.S. has taken steps to, you know, limit immigration of Chinese students studying STEM fields at U.S. universities, and economic espionage cases linked to China have also increased by like an enormous amount. And that threat is real. Like, I'm not going to downplay the extent of Chinese espionage in the U.S. economy. And so there is a reason for it, but it also has, you know, I don't know if it was like a similar case involving an Asian or Chinese student studying STEM, whether the outcome would have been so, let's just say that the process would have been a lot more politicized, as we're seeing
right now. That's a really good point, Lynn. And then just for people who aren't studying international relations, can you explain like the difference between soft power and hard power?
Okay, so soft power is essentially the power of alliances and relationships. And it's typically held through a lot of the international institutions, such as the United Nations, the WTO, just like world global organizations that are sort of non-binding. Hard power is more of through a mechanism of power that's demonstrated through money, commerce, tariffs, economic instruments. But soft power is something that I think the U.S. in particular has a lot of as the leader of a lot of these international institutions.
But the Trump administration pulled out from so many of these.
I mean, the past 4 years have been a wash for the U.S. on the global sphere. I think he's ruined a lot of relationships, maybe not completely destroyed them, but he's put a dent in a lot of alliances.
I think this is global trend of closing space, and the powers just react to each other's action. So it's really sad to see that close.
Impacted. Yeah. And when we talk about like just, I think from a personal level, right? Like, I think it's important that we clarify our backgrounds and how this closing of borders affects us personally, right? The three of us come from different backgrounds and I think have very different experiences. Like Hua, to your point, you're Chinese. You came to the States pretty late in life after you've already graduated from school. But Lynn, like you were born here in the US and your ties overseas is to Taiwan, right? So, I mean, maybe if it would be helpful if you can kind of go through like your relationship with the US and your relationship with China.
It's a loaded question. Yeah, I mean, I think it's, you know, at face value, it's a pretty straightforward one. I am American by birthright. I was born here, but my parents immigrated here from Taiwan. My dad came here for his master's and then eventually got his PhD and stayed here ever since. My mom joined him when he got his PhD as well. I was born and raised here. I feel very American, but I think like these days, when you ask, do you identify as American, what does that really mean? You know, aside from signifying that I was born here, I think the question really goes a lot deeper to fundamentally, like, what are the values of being American? And I think what has always tied me to America is the value of an individual as a fundamental unit, as a person who has dignity and certain rights. And it seems a little trite these days to talk about it, you know, like life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, especially at a time where we're seeing so much racial inequity in our own country. They seem sort of like devoid of their meaning. But personally, I feel really lucky to be born here in America, in the neighborhood that I was born in, with certain opportunities and rights. I know that's not necessarily uniform across the board in the U.S., mm-hmm. but personally for me, my, you know, my dad, he frequently reminds me of the numerous opportunities I had growing up in America that he didn't. And mm-hmm. so I'll often hear the love or at least respect that he has for America. And I don't necessarily see that identification with America translated in myself and or like my peers in our generation, because I feel like as of late, a lot of that patriotism has been turned into more of like disdain, maybe justifiably, towards America for its imperialist roots, its racism, and a certain maybe hubris that's been about like maybe like shoving, nudging other parts of the world towards a way of life that we think is right. And I don't know, maybe like our generation and the generations coming after us won't identify with that way of life, which has been distinctly American. That's a long-winded answer to your question about whether I identify as American. But I do think it does relate to our conversation around our relationship with US and our relationship with China, because we're at a pretty pivotal moment right now, particularly for Asian Americans, or just any American, in just defining the fundamental nature of what America means. And I think that's really been brought to the surface, especially this year in the midst of election chaos, you know, people COVID. Questioning the results of the election, COVID. Yes, yeah. So much like tumultuous stuff going on in our country. So really the fundamental right. nature of what America means is being questioned. And then to right. the other part, which is like my relationship with China. I mean, I am ethnically Chinese and I am proud of that, but I do distinctly identify as being Taiwanese. But I, you know, part of the reason why I want to study U.S.-China relations is because I'm fascinated by China as a country. I see its rise over the years as, you know, just such an impressive achievement and one that will fundamentally change our world, because you have the U.S. as sort of the reigning power for like the last few decades, and now China is really closing in on that. And so obviously I'm biased. I don't trust the Chinese Communist Party. I don't think that it values human life and dignity. And I think it is mostly a self-serving, power-hungry entity that's doing everything it can to cement its own power in a way that is not beneficial for the world. But I want to study it so that I can be more objective about the situation. And I also want to be clear that as we talk about China, we have to be careful about like distinguishing between China, the government, the Communist Party, and Chinese people. I obviously right. have friends who are Chinese who I respect and hold dearly. Hua, you know, like I don't have anything against Chinese people. When we're talking about China, we have to understand it's like Chinese people versus the Communist Party are two very distinct entities.
Right. Thank you for sharing, Lynn. Well, I'm curious from your perspective, being raised in China and then coming to the States, experiencing both cultures, like how you identify with the US and how you identify with China, and then having a husband who's American.
I was born and grew up in the old city of Beijing, literally the center mm-hmm. of Beijing, which show the historic places. The parks, the Forbidden City is just within walking distance from my home. So I'm a proud Chinese, and I'm always like nostalgic about the old Beijing, say 20 years ago in the 90s that I grew up, which was much smaller, much quieter, and mm-hmm. much more interesting than today. Very like a big cosmopolitan, like huge city, very commercial, and a lot mm-hmm. of places been landscape almost has been changed. I really love Beijing, my city, and the culture, and have friends there that we share values and interests, hobbies. So I'm really homesick at this moment, having been back for a whole year. And my grandma, I'm very proud of my grandma that she is 102 this year.
And oh my gosh.
Yes, she lived through all the revolutions in the last century. Herself is a legend to me, and I grew up with her. So that's the old, like, Chinese value, Chinese culture is a dear part of myself. And I think that is something that I, when I relate that part to Westerners, and people can easily relate that, the family, the culture, and the place you grew up, your emotion relating to that. China is, I mean, it's changing so fast. It's unbelievable that every year I went back to China, as a local being, yeah, something is different. It's not only like physically the city, the streets.
The people.
Yes, it's the people, the mindset, and how people see the outside world, how their exchange with the outside world has become so different.
Yeah.
Yeah, so that part is really striking to me. And every time I went back, my friends will persuade me, just find a job here. We'll support you, especially during the years that things are so limbo and I don't see any hope in this ordeal. And people persuade, why you don't come back to Beijing? We're here for you. But that part is, if I don't fight for my husband, who will? I'm the only English speaker in the entire family. I have to shoulder this, despite how difficult it is. And I want to respond to what Lin just said about the Chinese regime, the people, the society, the business world. I would say that so the regime need to survive, have to maintain the momentum to continue drawing economic growth. That is very critical to the entire country, to the people. I think a big accomplishment that we'll have to recognize is China did eliminate extreme poverty to get this one fifth of world population out of extreme poverty and create this middle class, which China is trying to bring this middle class to a status called self-reliance. As you read from the newest version of the five-year plan, that China is all about this self-reliance, because China is clearly cognitive about this closing space overall, and then from the West, from Europe and the United States, and how to do that. It is very ironic that at the same time that China and the United States are all in this closing space, China actually announced this week that China actually encouraged students going abroad. Well, their students are not, I mean, welcomed overseas. And what does it mean to this already interdependent globalized world? Like in China, in my university, only the best student from the best university, they go to America to study. It's like any developing country, because for two things, it's the beacon of liberty and people want to see the outside world, what it's like. And secondly, the United States has the best education in the world. But on the other hand, we see more and more Chinese, especially science students, go back to China immediately after their PhD. Because there's no opportunity, it's so devastating, and the academia, entire world is so sad. Limited resources and on top of this anti-China sentiment. But in return, you will see that China actually benefit from this. The best talent came back to the country to support the business and academia. This is, I don't know how this will unfold going forward. It depends on like Biden administration's China policy.
There's always two sides to the story. And I think you clearly have a very interesting perspective. You're able to point out both sides of the story of like America painting this picture that China's sending these people to America to steal America's trade secrets and then going back to China to expand the Chinese economy. And then on the flip side, from the perspective of the Chinese, it's like America's kind of creating this upon themselves by limiting H-1B visas, by limiting the number of opportunities that these highly educated people can obtain here in the States. Their best bet is going back to China to survive.
I think the policy changes that have happened in the last few years, particularly with visa restrictions, is a net loss to the U.S. because what you're seeing, particularly among students who come to the U.S. from China, is that I think most of them want to stay here, but we give them no choice because the U.S. has made it so hard to now come here to study and then also to stay here and find a job. So I think, you know, hopefully with the Biden administration, there is an opportunity to sort of reverse a lot of these visa restrictions that were put in place because international enrollment has gone down over the last 4 years. And so now there's an opportunity to launch initiatives that can welcome international students again, obviously do it in a way that's responsible and controlling for any like concerns that they have around intellectual property and transfer of trade secrets, all of that. But it's generally, yeah, a huge loss to the U.S. economy. And like you can see now just in particularly in STEM and quantum computing, how that relationship between the U.S. and China is just intensifying. And China's outspending the U.S. in all of this fundamental research that is probably going to be like the next, whatever, fourth industrial revolution. And so I think if you project further out into the next 10, 20 years, at the rate that China's going and at the rate their students are studying these technological fields, whether in China or abroad, and then bringing it back to China, they are going to far outpace the U.S. And I think my fear is that we're going to enter this era where the U.S. and China are like clear rivals. They don't even want to coexist. And we just live in this bifurcated world where, I mean, we kind of already are seeing it, where China has its own universe of its own media, all of its technology, and it's all blocked from the West. And the U.S. too is also cutting China off from our research, our technology, our media, which you can kind of see because mm-hmm. they've cut off all U.S. social platforms and technology from China. So we end up having two bifurcated worlds. I feel like our world just has too many global issues for that to be beneficial to anyone.
That's a really good point, Lynn. And just on a personal level, having family in China, I think the part that hit me the hardest was when they announced the WeChat ban, when my parents and I were trying to figure out what's a different way that we can communicate with each other. And it sort of blows my mind that we are in 2020 and communication is getting cut off. It's amazing that I could just send a text message to my parents halfway around the world and they receive it instantly and we're able to talk to each other. But here in 2020, I had to worry about being able to communicate with them and worry about the two countries that I feel very strongly as a part of see each other with animosity. Every time I read an article of like how China's using the CRISPR gene editing technology to create super soldiers, like it's just, it's like, it feels a bit like Cold War-ish. And there's all this like fear and dramatization of painting this picture that like this yellow peril that's like happening all over again in the United States. And I think to your point, Hua, the news and the articles and the sentiment that I'm seeing from Chinese people, mostly through like reading articles on WeChat that my parents send me, is this like feeling from Chinese people that they're like, well, who needs the US? Like the US is going downhill nowadays anyway. Like who needs them? Right. And so there's this like sentiment of kind of animosity towards Western cultures. And, you know, anecdotally, when I lived in Shanghai in the early 2000s, while I was going to high school, Chinese people would always like look at foreigners like they're these amazing people, like they come from different countries and there's so much to learn from them and they're so different from us. And they were kind of held on a pedestal. And nowadays, when I go back to China, like they're shunned. There's like a significant lack of foreigners in Shanghai nowadays. And so it's very interesting to sort of see the closing off on both sides and the misinformation and the miscommunication and the misunderstandings between two cultures. And part of me feels, I feel very sad about that because I personally feel like a bridge between the two.
Something we talked about earlier, just like how domestic interests really do intersect with international. And we're seeing that across the board in China, also here in the US. I think this draws upon this like larger issue around the downsides and the merits of an open international economic system, you know, globalization and its effects. So like you said, I think globalization, China opening itself up has been good for the very poor. It's lifted a lot of people out of poverty. It's been good for the very rich as well. But it hasn't been so great for the middle class in advanced economies. So I think the middle class in the US has really struggled. Mm-hmm. And with that triggers a lot of instability. And that domestic instability that we face here in the US affects our relationship with all other countries. Because people are seeing the US as a country that doesn't have its shit together. And we are no longer seen as a country that is competent, that can be a leader. But similarly, China is also facing its own domestic issues as well. Like you mentioned, Hua, you know, a low birth rate, a really rapidly aging population. It's also experiencing slowing growth. And while a lot of people have been lifted out of poverty, and we talk about the urbanization, there's still a lot of people struggling, I'd say, in rural areas and villages in China. And the currency there is still far from rivaling the US dollar. So I think like on both sides, the domestic issues really fuel the international tensions. And when we have instability in any country, you see the rise of populism and nationalism. And that's part of the reason why we got Donald Trump. And I hope that the next administration, we can sort of come to this like common sense, pragmatic realization that one country succeeding at the expense of another is not beneficial to the world. And some country is going to have to take the mantle and be the leader. And traditionally, the US has been the leader in that. And in the last 4 years, we've shown that we don't want to be a leader in that form. And I think we are all experiencing the consequences of that now.
Yeah, I think this is extremely important. The United States should continue leaning forward to lead in the digital field, which is largely not regulated at this point. I think that the European has been leading, for example, recently in the artificial intelligence and automation civil liability issue. And when there is no rule and just targeting China and criminalizing China and Chinese people and business is not fair, where there's no largely this legal framework in place. But I would like to say that the United States has been very successful in promoting the FCPA, the Foreign Corruption Act overseas, which really improved the market environment in China because of this FCPA, because of foreign companies' interaction with Chinese companies, state-owned companies, that really changed the business environment alongside with China's anti-corruption campaign. I think in the digital field, I would really look forward seeing the United States continue lead in this field, not in a way to close space, but to even the playing field so everybody can compete with transparency and accountability.
I think at the end of the day, it obviously, to both of your points, it comes down to what sort of domestic issues each country needs to solve, what sort of things could be beneficial on a foreign policy side. Like, I think at the end of the day, it is very strategic. It is like a game of chess. At the end of the day, like, both countries are trying to move forward and try to do what's best for their people. Ideally, that's the way that you would think a government should govern. But I do think that in recent years, there's been a bit of this zero-sum gain mentality where it's, mm-hmm. I need to do what's best for my people mm-hmm. at any cost. And let's not think about the global ramifications. And I would argue these days that country boundaries are a lot more blurred than they used to be, especially with globalization, with companies going across multiple countries to produce their products. Every country's economy becoming more and more intertwined. It's going mm-hmm. to be really interesting because I wonder if humanity is able to take a step back instead of being very tribal and thinking only of their own tribes or countries or their own benefits, to start thinking more globally. How do you advance all of humanity? And it's hard. And I think that what America has been doing in the media of finding a common culprit or a common enemy or a common bad person is because the citizens of America are so split amongst each other. And that's potentially the best way of creating solidarity yeah. and creating a way mm-hmm. to get everybody on the same page. And then in terms of China, I mean, to Hua's point, I think China is still kind of in survival mode. They're just trying to figure it out. Like they're trying to appease 1.3 billion people, which is four times the size of the US. And they're trying to advance the economy at all costs. And still, I think, you know, to Hua's point, like they're still very much behind the US and trying to catch up. So it's a definitely interesting power dynamics. And I think by saying all that, it kind of trickles down to us like everyday people where we're starting to see the impacts of this. Like, you know, I'm seeing that I'm going to have a hard time communicating with my parents if this keeps going on, right? Like with technology sort of like closing their doors. And then every time I'm in China, like I have a really hard time accessing Google or Facebook or anything, right?
Yeah.
And at the end of the day, like the people who are suffering, I feel like are the ones who are kind of in between who would like the two countries to play nice with each other.
Yeah, that was well put. I mean, I think to just one quick point about, you know, what the future of the world looks like, I think we will have no choice but to find a way to coexist and cooperate. Like I'm very much an idealist, so maybe this is naive. In international relations terms, they'd call me like a liberal internationalist and not a realist. But I do believe that in the world we live in today, we're going to be up against a lot of universal threats like climate change and nuclear warfare and COVID. I mean, right here in our midst. And China and the U.S. as the two sort of leading superpowers will really be forced to find a way to cooperate. Otherwise, I just don't feel like this form of instability that we're in, akin to like a Cold War, is sustainable. Or maybe this will become the new norm. I don't know. But I think like if we want to pave the way for a world where it's not such a zero-sum game and we recognize that other countries are just trying to do what's best for themselves and survive, I think we can lower the stakes a bit and realize that we have another common enemy, which is something like climate change. And that's really going to be up against like all of humanity.
I just want to say everything you just said. I think there's a question mark of liberal universalism, if that is still a valid pursuit, even for the United States or Europe, and how to reconcile with countries coming with different background, history, mm-hmm. and then ideological difference. And with the global value chain, I'm swaying away from the free world towards a wider world and how to cope with this. I do feel the world will become more regionalized than globalized according to the one world rule leading by the American hegemon, but overall, I mean, it is to everybody's benefit if there is more cooperation despite the differences in value and also in national economy and everything else.
So you're a liberal internationalist too, Hua.
Yes.
That's my guess. I've been trying to like pinpoint that in class. I haven't been sure because I feel like our class is actually filled with realists.
That's the mainstream in today's world.
That's the gist of this today's episode, is that we identified that Hua is also a liberal internationalist. Thank you both so much for sharing your thoughts and your backgrounds. And, you know, Hua, thank you for sharing and opening up about your story of your husband. I think this has been really enlightening for me to be able to see both sides of the story and to hear just personal anecdotes of how US and China has affected you personally. And hopefully this segment and this episode can really help some other people who feel like they're in the in-between zone or who are curious about a different perspective on US-China relations, that this could be helpful to them. And maybe we can gather more liberal internationalists. And that concludes season 5 of Rock the Boat. You can hear more of Hua's husband's story on a short NPR piece that I've linked in the show notes. For expanded reading of some reputable Chinese media outlets, you can visit taixinglobal.com. For someone who wishes for both the US and for China to do well, my hopes are that the next administration can approach China as a partner and not an adversary. Happy holidays, everyone, and I'll see you in the new year. Please support the podcast by subscribing to it on iTunes, Spotify, Google Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts. Leave us a 5-star rating if you're listening on iTunes, and definitely tell your friends about it. You can follow us on Instagram at RockTheBoatNYC and subscribe to our mailing list for inside news. Thanks to my associate producer, Rachel Chu, for editing and mixing this episode. Thanks for tuning in, and until next time.